Dr. Stan, and of course this evening we're going to have a very, very special guest, hopefully. His name is Gregory Burnham, and Gregory was 6 years old when President Kennedy was assassinated back in 1963. Because he lived in Washington, D.C., they went to the funeral, and he was always concerned about the murder of an American president. Now, because I was practicing medicine at the time, I remember being in surgery at the time. Maybe many of you remember what you were doing at the time when President Kennedy was assassinated, at least if you're old enough to. But if you begin thinking back, why, it was certainly a time that affected all of our lives. Well, Gregory set out to try to find out the truth about the assassination. I guess even as a very young person, he always had a feeling that we had never gotten the entire truth. In fact, certainly Richard Russell, Senator Russell, who was on the Warren Commission, felt the same way, as did Hale Boggs, as did at least three of the seven members of the Warren Commission. Of course, Hale Boggs died under very mysterious circumstances shortly after the commission. Senator Russell and Hale Boggs wanted to write a minority report, but they were never allowed to. And to this very date, there's a great deal of question as far as what really happened as far as the murder of an American president. Now, people say, well, why is that important? That was 38 years ago. Well, why it's important is because they never could have had a coup d'etat and killed the American president and replaced him with a different administration without the help of the intelligence agencies, without the help of the CIA, without the help of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and Mr. Hoover, without certainly the help of the media in America, without the help of people highly placed within our government. It just couldn't have been done. Now, since the assassination, of course, there have been a lot of confusing information put out. I mean, there is the theory, and I'll have to admit at one time, when I was young and foolish, I believed the propaganda that was put out by many of the anti-communist organizations that the Soviets had been behind it, because there was so much evidence suggesting that Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist. After all, he had gone to Russia. He had learned to speak Russian. He renounced his American citizenship, or tried to. Then he got himself a job. He was working in a very key position. I shouldn't say a key position. He was working in a factory, but he was given a very luxurious apartment, which ordinarily would never be given to just the average individual. He was allowed to marry the niece of a colonel in the Soviet secret police, Marina Oswald. And then, of course, when he came back to the United States, why, our government paid his way back to the United States. And then, of course, he was involved with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, supporting Fidel Castro. He was actually seen passing out pamphlets supporting Fidel Castro, and of course there were many of the anti-Castro Cubans who were just furious with him, and there was just so much evidence showing he was a communist. The only trouble was, Lee Harvey Oswald was never a communist. He was never a pro-communist. He was never a socialist. In fact, on our four-tape set on the Kennedy assassination, you'll hear of the interview with Lee Harvey Oswald, done before long before he killed the president. And you'll find that there's a very well-schooled young man who's thinking very, very quickly, who has been very well-trained. All the evidence shows, of course, he was a CIA asset, the man who controlled him. Des Moines Schultz was a CIA asset. And we even carry a book entitled Lee Harvey Oswald and the CIA. Really no question at all that he was working for our government, and that he was a patsy. All the evidence shows that he didn't actually kill the president. There were several shooter teams there at Dealey Plaza that were to kill off the president. Well, we've got Greg on the line. Greg Burnham, how are you tonight?
I'm doing fine. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, thank you. And good. It's so good to have you with us. And I just sort of introduced you. I told the people how you've been studying this ever since you were 6 years old, and you saw the... you attended the funeral of an American president. So why don't you sort of pick up this story? You've actually, of course, tracked down a number of government documents. These were all supposed to be sealed until the year 2020, but you've been able to get them by one means or another. And you were telling us this one about this CIA document. Now, for our listener out there, you have to understand the CIA is never to have anything to do with America. It's all of its operations to be overseas. However, what is a CIA document that you have that's been declassified say?
I think then you're referring to the document that is basically, it went out to several stations and station chiefs, and it basically was advising agents on how to deal with criticism of the Warren Commission report. That was the title of the document, Countering Criticism of the Warren Report.
Which was the official party line that Lee Harvey Oswald operated by himself. He was a lone, deranged young man.
Yes. And for those listeners who would like to get a copy of this themselves, they can get my email address later, or you can go to the National Archives or write to them. The document number is 1035-960. And kind of to cut to the chase, because it is it's about 4 or 5 pages long, I assume that's what you would like me to do.
Sure, yeah, but I don't want the full 5 pages.
Yeah, right. Well, something I didn't point out, this is, I think, our 4th show together, and one thing I hadn't pointed out, something very in bold in all capital letters on this document says, destroy when no longer needed. And it's just kind of a little curious also to note that that was an instruction on the document itself. Additionally, like you had already said, the CIA is not authorized and it is illegal for them to function domestically. However, this document says that we do not recommend that discussion of the assassination question be initiated where it is not already taking place, and where discussion is active, however, addressees are requested to A, discuss the publicity problems with liaison and friendly elite contacts, especially politicians and editors, pointing out that the Warren Commission made as thorough an investigation as humanly possible, and that the charges of the crimes are without serious foundation, and that further speculative discussion only plays into the hands of the opposition.
Now, that sort of reminds me of what President Bush said recently. We don't want to hear any conspiracy theories. They only help the terrorists.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting concept that almost, since November 22nd, 1963, and of course, I wasn't born, 6 years before that was when I was born, 1957, so I certainly cannot speak to anything that occurred before then from firsthand experience. But I do know, and from my reading and from my studies, that the word conspiracy never had the stigma to it that it has today. That occurred as a result of the assassination in Dallas, Texas, 38 years ago, that anyone who disputed the Warren Commission's report, that anyone who said that there's something wrong with this picture, that anyone who told the truth, basically, that said you cannot fire 3 shots from a Mannlicher Carcano, a 23-year-old rifle, that was retired by the Italian army because it couldn't hit anything that it was deliberately aimed at, it has a bolt action, you can't fire that in 5.6 seconds. So just on its face, that part of it doesn't work. The rest of it, the more you hear and the more you put together, none of it works. Just by virtue of the fact that you would question the story and that you would criticize the report, you're automatically labeled a conspiracy theorist. And yet, almost every crime in the United States, almost without exception, involves conspiracy. Even bank robbers, very rarely is it some lone, quote-unquote, nut bank robber who robbed the bank. Generally speaking, they even have accomplices.
And, of course, there was a conspiracy to attack the World Trade Center on September 11th. Obviously, it was a conspiracy.
Well, yeah, very difficult to cover that one up because you had, 2 separate planes just for the World Trade Center buildings, and you had a third one for the Pentagon, so it was kind of hard at that point to say Timothy McVeigh did it.
All right.
But if they could have, they may have, for all I know. A very tragic thing, occurred in New York. And probably the most important part to the investigation and the continued investigation and discovery of the truth about the John F. Kennedy assassination is because of what it means to us today, not only because that was our president and there has never been a trial and the story has not been told yet, but furthermore that when you can get away with that for 38 years, you can get away with anything. And so the doubt that comes into people's minds when they hear about new things that happen and difficulties with the CIA and drugs, you don't know what to think. People hear that and they go, oh, no, some conspiracy theorist again. Folks, I'll tell you what, conspiracy, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said, in politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can believe and bet it was planned to happen that way.
In fact, in the volume one of the, or part one of this new report that we're offering on Homeland Security, it's called, it's the report of the United States Commission on Internal Security in the 21st Century. And on page three, it said, history does not just happen, it is created. History does not just happen, it's created. And, of course, the people who wrote that report have been helping to create the history as we see it unfolding before our eyes, because, of course, the whole report, 145 pages, the underlying theme is, we're going to have terrorist attacks on America. We're going to have an awful lot of Americans killed here in America by these terrorist attacks. And, of course, the entire theme of the commission is, we're going to have the Office of Homeland Security created, and that was stipulated back in the year 2000. And, of course, Gary Hart, co-chairman of the committee, speaking at the meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations on the 14th of September, just 3 days after the attack, said, well, the president may be able to use this disaster to create what his father referred to only perhaps one time, I think, and that was a new world order. In other words, Gary Hart, co-chairman of the committee that talks about history as doesn't just happen, it's created, said, you know, we can use, the president can use this disorder, this disaster. And they certainly are using it, getting, moving us towards an increasingly authoritarian society here at home, moving us towards a new world order throughout the rest of the world. So I think that what we need to do is question how the intelligence agencies deceived the American people, because it never could have been done. I'm sure there are a lot of people within the CIA and the FBI who knew what was going on and would love to have come forward. But if you did, why, of course, you would lose your job. And if you've read the book Dead Witnesses, you'll find out that 109 of the people who witnessed one or another aspect of the Kennedy assassination, the murder, the coup d'etat, 109 of them died, or at least most of them died under very mysterious circumstances.
And I think even just the fact that they were dead in the period of time, whether we know if it was mysterious or not, just the commonality that they had that one thing in common, and yet that percentage of persons died with that commonality, may be a significant statistical number.
I suspect that you wouldn't want to be the life insurance company that was insuring anybody that witnessed what happened there in Dealey Practice Plaza that day, in November of 1963, or the things that happened surrounding the other people, Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald, etc.
Well, I don't think insurance company. I don't think you can buy short like you can in the stock market.
No. Or like the people who bought short and a couple of days before the September 11th attack, and even the president of the German Bundesbank said they had to have prior knowledge. So let's go ahead and what things have you uncovered? You have... you found actually something having to do with the ammunition for this this rifle that the Italian government had done away with because it was no good. Where did the ammunition that was found there in the Texas Book Depository come from?
Well, it came from, you know, this is from an FBI document that I'm holding in my hand. I've had this for quite some time. It is dated the 2nd of December, 1963. So this is the assassination was November 22nd. So this is just within a week or a little over that 10 days or so. And it says, this is from Mr. Jevons of the FBI to Mr. Conrad. And it's my memorandum of 11/28/63 set out additional information relating to the sale and distribution of the Western manufactured 6.5 millimeter Mannlicher Carcano ammunition used in the assassination. That memorandum was written in response to Mr. Belmont's instructions. Belmont was one of the top people for Hoover in the FBI. That memorandum was written in response to Mr. Belmont's instructions that every effort be made to trace the ammunition to the possibility that some of it may be traced into Oswald's hands. The Springfield office has advised that they have obtained through contact at the Western Cartridge Corporation, East Dalton, Illinois, copies of that corporation's records relating to the manufacture of this ammunition. Western manufactured 4 million rounds of this ammunition for the United States Marine Corps during 1954. So again, this is going to make it 9-year-old ammunition, by the way. Continuing, attached is a 2-page copy of this of the records of Western relating to the complete manufacture of this order of ammunition, which was authorized under government contract DA-23196-ORD-27. The interesting thing about this order is that it is for ammunition which does not fit and cannot be fired in any of the United States Marine Corps weapons. This gives rise to the obvious speculation that it is in a contract for ammunition placed by CIA with Western under a USMC cover for concealment purposes.
Now, is that what the FBI is saying?
Everything I just read is in this FBI document.
So the FBI is considering this was purchased by the CIA as part of some undercover operation.
Absolutely. Colonel Prouty, as you're well aware, L. Fletcher Prouty, who was the chief of special operations, he was the liaison, focal point officer and liaison between the Central Intelligence Agency and the entire military, not just Air Force, but all branches of the military, so that when the CIA had to do a clandestine operation and they needed support for it, he was the person that would coordinate that for them. He has often said that this is how it's done, that the contract will be let through one of the military services because you can't just come right out and say, well, the CIA is going to do this or whatever intelligence organization is going to do that. It has to go through some kind of an organization of the military to make something like this happen. So this is very much in line with what we already know from the great reportage that he has done over the years. This is a contract right here for the ammunition that came through the United States Marine Corps for 6.5 Mallet-Kirkcano ammunition. Well, we know that the Marine Corps does not use Italian rifles. They don't use Mallet-Kirkcano. In fact, nobody used. In 1963, even the Italians wouldn't use a Mallet-Kirkcano.
Oh, but of course, support the belief that Lee Harvey Oswald was able to get off three lucky shots, and two of them, of course, hitting the president, and one of them miraculously going through President Kennedy, then slanting upward so it would go through Governor Connally's chest, and then it would go through Governor Connally's right wrist and leave all sorts of bullet fragments and lead debris, and then it would go into Governor Connally's left thigh and leave all sorts of debris, and then it would miraculously reconstitute itself to be found in pristine condition, looking like it had just been fired into a wad of cotton, lying on the gurney in the emergency room there at Parkland Hospital, where Governor Connally, it was the gurney that Governor Connally was lying on. And of course, there's no way that this could be the case. You know, bullets don't reconstitute themselves, because did you ever have a chance to talk to Dr. Crenshaw, who was there in the emergency room when Governor Connally was brought in?
Actually, I never did speak with Dr. Crenshaw.
Well, we have a fascinating interview with him. It's in our 4-tape set on the Kennedy assassination. And he said, you know, they were just taking all his lead out of the right wrist and out of the left thigh. So there was a lot of debris left. In fact, when Governor Connally died, some people wanted to do an autopsy to get the rest of the lead out of the left thigh. The family wouldn't allow it. And why should they? It's obvious it didn't come from this bullet, because there was hardly any lead missing from the bullet. It's simply the markings, the rifling. So this was obviously a cover-up, and then they had to sell that magic bullet. How did they sell that magic bullet to the American people, this bullet that could zigzag back and forth and then reconstitute itself, which is why it was called the magic bullet?
You know, again, here's a fascinating thing, in my opinion anyway, it's a fascinating thing, that Arlen Specter, who is now senator, of course, of the state of Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter is the person who allegedly invented this single bullet or magic bullet theory.
He was actually an assistant counsel for the Warren Commission, wasn't he?
Yes, and what I want to point out here is I literally never, and that's a strong word, so maybe I shouldn't say never, but almost never would I recommend to anybody that they actually read the Warren Commission report. And the reason I say that is this, not so that they're ignorant about what it says, but because it doesn't say anything. I guess one needs to take what I just even said with a grain of salt. I guess it does say something, but it's not really pertinent to what the case was about in many, many ways.
And when they wouldn't ask the right questions. If people tried to give the right answers, they would discredit them. And they went all the way around the circle to avoid allowing any of the truth to get into the record, and our inspector played an important part in that.
Well, yes. Now, occasionally, something will come up from that report. I forced myself to read it and get through it because of what I do. I needed to know what it said. And every once in a while, a fascinating thing will happen. As you're aware, in a regular trial, of course, the Warren Commission was not a trial. Lee Harvey Oswald was never tried for the murder of JFK. The fact that history, as a result of the report of the Warren Commission, has condemned him makes no sense whatsoever and has no legitimacy in terms of American jurisprudence. But, nonetheless, if one goes to the Warren Commission, eventually you're going to find so many discrepancies. And my point here, the first point is this, is that in a court of law, if the prosecution introduces evidence that ends up not being good for their case, the defense is allowed to reintroduce that in order to have it impeach itself. Okay? But the prosecution may be restricted by the courtroom, and the defense may object any time the prosecution introduces that evidence because it's already been shown to be false, to be erroneous, to be lies. So once, and it's almost like a perjury witness. If somebody perjures themselves and it's obvious on the stand, can the defense recall that witness if it was a prosecution witness? Absolutely. That witness may, in fact, take the Fifth Amendment so that they do not incriminate themselves, you see, but the defense could prevent the prosecution from ever using that witness again, but the defense can use it whenever possible and whenever they want to, okay? My point is this. The Warren Commission report is very similar to that in that it impeaches itself. It is inconsistent with itself. So from a defense standpoint, even though I say I don't recommend anyone read it in terms of being factual, occasionally you will find something in it that is so exculpatory of Oswald and incriminatory of, the, for lack of a better word, the government or those people in power that created this cover story, that at that point then it has some value. And the interesting thing is that it was a testimony of one of the witnesses that testified for the Warren Commission and was questioned by our inspector. The first time I ever noticed this, I couldn't believe it was last year, that the single bullet theory doesn't appear to have been Arlen Specter's idea at all. That the word was put out on the streets of Dallas, this idea of some bullet that hit Kennedy first and then did all this damage and went to Connolly and did this and that and the other thing, because the first time Arlen Specter seems to have ever heard of it is when he is talking to Gene Hill. So I recommend people to go to that part, at least of the Warren Commission, and find out where the single bullet theory came from. I'm not saying that Gene Hill invented that. I'm saying that she had heard it herself, and during her testimony, she said, well, gee, you know, Mr. Specter, I've heard this and that and the other, and I guess what I'm telling you that I saw probably doesn't make too much difference because, well, what I've heard about this bullet that did all this stuff. And Specter basically says, well, where did you hear that? Where did you hear that? And it's very apparent when you read this that it's almost as though he's never even heard. I mean, I look at this and I say, what exactly does that mean? Because she couldn't have gotten it from the news. It had not even gotten to the news or to newspapers in any way, shape, or form prior to this testimony that she gave to Specter for her Warren Commission testimony.
So I find that what's really what's fascinating about it is this bullet would have had to change direction three or four times to have done what it did. And that's the tragic situation, is that they were actually able to sell that to the American people. That one instance alone, this bullet that danced back and forth and then reconstituted itself, was the explanation, because they said there were only three bullets were fired. Well, there were probably 8 or 10 bullets fired from the various teams that were there. People who have analyzed this are quite convinced of it. Now, one of the most interesting things about the story was the story put forward by Madeline Duncan Brown, who we have actually interviewed here. She was the mistress for Lyndon Johnson. And I'm grateful to her for telling us the story about the meeting she attended the night before President Kennedy was assassinated. Do you recall who Madeline Duncan Brown said was at that meeting?
Well, I believe it was at Clint Murchison's house, first of all. Of course, Hunt was there, another one of the big oil powers in Texas. Of course, we know that LBJ was there. We know that J. Edgar Hoover was there. A number of other people.
John McCloy.
John McCloy, who ended up on
Richard
the
Nixon. Right.
Now, I didn't know that Nixon was there.
Yeah, Nixon was apparently was there, according to Madeline Duncan Brown. And, of course, Nixon felt that Kennedy had stolen the election from him, which he did. Actually, he didn't steal it. His father did by getting the mafia to rig the election in Chicago.
You know, at the risk of, at the risk of my own life, let me just say something very, very carefully here. Those interested need to look up a man named Charles Kane, who was involved in the most recent presidential election. Charles Kane is also... You can go to the electorate for the state of Florida and just punch into the search engine on the internet, Charles Kane. He was also involved in the 1960 election in Chicago, at least that district, that area of the country, that contributed to JFK's apparently winning the state of Illinois. There's been a lot of talk about Sam Giancana being directly involved in that, but the indications are that it was Charles Kane. Charles Kane also testified for a courtroom in Florida when the idea had been questioned about the tampering with the ballots in Florida this year. And yet...
He must be getting to be a pretty old man by now.
Yet you cannot find... You cannot find... And you, when you request the transcript of the courtroom, where he testified and said that he used to be with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and he was with the Central Intelligence Agency under oath, you cannot get that transcript.
Isn't that interesting? Well, there are a lot of strange things go on today. Well, anyway, of course, this meeting is held the night before the assassination. Madeline Duncan Brown's written a book about it, and the interview we did, she tells how the men adjourned themselves late in the evening. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, John McCloy, the Murchisons, H.L. Hunt, who was a very dedicated anti-communist, and he hated Kennedy because he thought he was soft on communism, J. Edgar Hoover, all went into another room, came back later, and of course Madeline was expecting, LBJ to whisper something sweet and affectionate in her ear, and instead of that he said, after tomorrow, those... Kennedy boys aren't going to embarrass me or give me a bad time again. And she didn't understand until the next day when the president was assassinated. She said that several weeks later she asked him about it, and he simply said the oil men wanted to get rid of JFK, and that was all he would say about it. So we'll be back here in just a moment. You got this evening is Gregory Burnham, and I'm going to put out his website here in just a moment. Let me remind you, if you're out there listening to us across America, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you have a question or comment, because Gregory is one of the best informed people on this issue that I know of. Again, a telephone number to call here, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Gregory, how can people go onto your website? And we want to talk a little bit about some of the amazing things you have there. But how can people get to your website?
If you just type in the address field on I think that's what you call it anyway, the address field. That's what I call
the
it.
The search engine. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, www.jfkdrag.net. It's a play on words. It's jfkdragnet, but just put a period before the N-E-T.
All right, fine. Now, you've actually got... taken down from the CNN site. Some of the conversations from the Oval Office, these were recorded by Lyndon Johnson.
Well, actually, it's not CNN. I have my own tape recording of these. However, C-SPAN has a number of these available on their website as well.
All right, fine. Well, what's up there that people might be interested in listening there? You're listening, you're eavesdropping on the President of the United States, and he recorded these for history. So what do you find there?
Almost everything that one would, if you wanted to really eavesdrop on what was going on during the time of the immediate transition of power from the Kennedy administration to the Johnson administration, and if you wanted to hear the conversations between LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, the conversations are there. There's conversations between LBJ and the director of CIA, at that time was a man named John McCone, because Alan Dulles, of course, had been fired after the Bay of Pigs, and then LBJ appointed Dulles to the Warren Commission, but that's another story. There's also conversations between LBJ and Dulles as well. Conversations between LBJ and Gerald Ford, the former President Ford, who also was on the Warren Commission. He had been in the House of Representatives.
Now, wasn't he the one who said he really didn't have time, he didn't want to get there, and then, of course, when you listen to the conversation, why, he was willing to break his neck to get there?
Well, yeah, basically, I mean, I saw an interview with him a year or so ago. I'm not sure when it was recorded, but about a year ago is when I saw it. And they asked him, you know, your contribution to the Warren Commission report, and what do you think of that whole thing? And he said they did the best they could and this and that and the other. And he went on to say that LBJ was just such a persuasive and, individual, you couldn't say no to him. And he said, I didn't want to be on the commission. I tried to get out of it. I told him I was too busy to do it. But there was just no saying no to Lyndon Baines Johnson. And he just really kind of, pushed so hard, and I ended up just kind of agreeing to it, and we got it done anyway. Well, if you listen to the conversation between LBJ and Jerry Ford, when LBJ first called him up and he talks to him, there's no resistance, there's no I don't have time. He, in fact, of the seven members, was the easiest one, I was going to say, to convince. LBJ, he didn't have to convince them. The guy almost volunteered. No, sure, Mr. President, anything I can do to help, thank you for calling.
Now what about the conversation between Senator Richard Russell, who was actually on the commission, and LBJ? He didn't really believe this report, did he?
No, and those conversations alone are worthwhile checking out for anybody interested in the subject. First of all, Richard Russell was the chairman of the Armed Services Commission, or committee, in the Senate. He was also the mentor of LBJ. And he did not want to be on the Warren Commission at all. And you can hear that definitely in his voice. And he was basically browbeaten by LBJ into being on it. Russell did not like Earl Warren, expresses it very strongly that he did not want to be on the commission, but basically gets his arm twisted, and he was, LBJ says he says almost word for word, I can't stick the IRS or the FBI on you. But you're doggone going to serve on the commission. Of course, he didn't say doggone. So I don't know if that's a threat or how to determine that. But Russell did get on the commission. And 9 days before the report of the Warren Commission was released, LBJ had called him up, or he had called LBJ, I'm not sure which, and they were talking. And LBJ says, well, how come you got out of town so quickly? And you seem so upset, and this and that. And Russell, in a nutshell, says, well, that doggone Warren Commission was beating me down, so I just wanted to get out of town. And he says, well, why? And Russell says, well, the commission, they're writing this up, that the commission says that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. And LBJ misunderstands and says, well, what difference does it make which bullet hit Connally? And Russell says, well, it doesn't make any difference. But they're trying to say the same one that hit Kennedy hit Connally, and I don't believe it. And LBJ says, I don't either. So 9 days before the Warren Commission report came out, you see, we have the President of the United States talking to one of the members of the Warren Commission, the senator from Georgia, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and neither of them believe what eventually became in our history books for our children to read and believe.
And, of course, it just simply reflects the degree of control that today exists of what the American people think. And these are the sort of things that are available. We have so much more access to information now than we've ever had before through the Internet and through alternative radio like this. But, how do we get people concerned enough about their freedom and the future of their children to be willing to take the time to find out what the truth is and then to act on it? And so many people seem to think, oh, well, it's not my responsibility, everything's in God's hands. And I don't like to say, well, if everything's in God's hands, he's doing a terrible, terrible job. Maybe your God is in charge, but mine is not. Not that he couldn't intervene, because he always intervenes eventually, but of course he usually allows the people to make the mistakes before he intervenes as far as the major events in the world. And just looking around you, do you honestly believe this is what God really wants? I mean, the abortion, the immorality. Turn on your television set and watch MTV. Watch almost most of the programs. Watch Touched by an Angel, where they're never allowed to mention the name of Jesus Christ. Look and see what's being taught in so many churches today. Nothing at all about God ever being a God of judgment, or what Erwin Lutzer, the senior pastor of the Moody Church in Chicago, talks about your eternal reward, and with the theme that there's going to be an awful lot of tears shed in heaven of remorse from people who may gain entrance for eternity to heaven, but of course for what they didn't do here on earth. So, I mean, unfortunately, the message that we're getting from many of our ministers has nothing to do with the traditional message that was taught 200 years ago. For had the churches 200 years ago taught what's being taught today, would still be British subjects. Anyway, if you have the access, get this information, and certainly get to Greg's website, which is jfkdrag.net. And I think that's a very, very clever... that should be easy for people to remember.
I should tell you that the actual web address is so long because it's one of those special web servers where you don't have to pay money for the tremendous amount of space they give you there. But the penalty, you see, is having an extremely long name that no one can remember. So I was able to somehow get the shorter name and get that linked together. So I apologize for any advertising that pops up when you're there. That's not my doing, but you can just basically ignore the advertising.
All right, fine. Well, the important thing is it's up there, and you can either watch it or read it, or you can listen to it. And I think that's fascinating, and I appreciate the fact that these clips are available. There's a new book written on those recordings, and one of them is on the Gulf of Tonkin incident, where President Johnson is talking to Robert McNamara and saying, "You lied to me. You told me that the Gulf of Tonkin incident took place, and it didn't take place at all." And, you know, and yeah, all those boys died for nothing over there, thinking that we were fighting and it was all a contrived war. It's about time people got the history. This is recorded. You don't have that one on your website, do you?
You know, I may. I would need to specifically look at it, but...
It's recorded. Anybody wants the clipping out of the New York Times, we'll be glad to send it to them if you just...
You're talking about with McNamara?
Right, with McNamara.
You know, one thing worth mentioning, by the way, is that at the C-SPAN website that has the conversations of LBJ's White House tapes, is what they're called, there's numerous McNamara recordings there that anyone can listen to on the Internet. However, one of them that you'll find listed there, but it says audio unavailable, and so there's nothing to click on, is the one with him speaking to McNamara about the Warren Commission report just being released. And I just find it very fascinating that, you know, there's not very many people from that administration really that are still, you know, alive. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I can't imagine why that would be unavailable for people to listen to. I don't know what it says. Who knows? Maybe when it comes out, it will be nothing, and it will all be innocuous.
That's right. Well, there's the book written, and I've really got to get the author of that on. But we're getting a long ways away from our major subject. What are some of the other documents that you've gotten? And apparently, you've gotten a lot of the documents that Colonel Fletcher Prouty had, haven't you?
Oh, well, yeah. I have a number of, tremendous number from him, tremendous number from other folks. One fascinating one, I would say, was November 27th, 1963. This is 4 days after the assassination. It's a National Security Agency document. I'll just read it. Four, it says, then it's, of course, redacted. First reactions in the United Nations after Kennedy's assassination. Number one, a unanimous opinion exists that there was, in the most favorable circumstances, East-West relations will deteriorate in the next few months and may last until election time, or elections, pardon me. Kennedy's assassination will a little bit hard to read that, will deepen the break in the Democratic Party between the North and the South. Johnson, comma, weak and subject to influence, will be forced to concentrate on stopping this process. Goldwater's position will decline, which will increase Rockefeller's chances for the nomination. The result of the elections, for the most part, will depend on the popularity of the Democratic candidates. Being mentioned are Humphrey, Robert, and American journalists in talks emphasize Johnson's liberal past. It is said that he was Roosevelt's favorite and his moderate position in critical periods during Kennedy's term. It is alarming that anti-communist hysteria has been turned on. Radio and television continue to broadcast unconfirmed reports that held as a suspect in the assassination is a man who, it is said, asked for Soviet citizenship 2 years ago, has a Russian wife, and who recently was an activist in the Fair Play for Cuba pro-Castro organization.
And that was part of the disinformation that was put out by the CIA at that time to try to make people think that the communists were responsible, to detract people away, of course, from the involvement of our own intelligence agencies in the murder.
Yes, and there's one last sentence to this document at the end, and I read the entire document except for one sentence. American extremists having great influences in the propaganda apparatus here want at all costs to be divorced from responsibilities for the attempt. That's an NSA document 4 days after the assassination.
Okay, well, I think it's amazing you've gotten all of these. And, of course, Lever is not supposed to be released, under the Freedom of Information Act was passed, then some of these now are available.
Some of these are now available, yes.
But there's still an awful lot that they're concealing, aren't there? An awful lot of the material they just will not release, or they'll redact it so much you can't understand it?
Well, and there's a kind of a neat device going on as well, that when you have the number of documents, and you and I discussed this before, if in fact Lee Harvey Oswald had done this, which there is incredible evidence that is exculpatory of Oswald, that he actually had nothing to do with it, but even if we were to assume that he did, even if you were to assume that the true story has been told, the big problem would be this. It would at that point be, for lack of a better word, a simple homicide involving one person because he was disgruntled, a loner, whatever we want to put to this. But at that point, why in the world do you need to have tens of thousands of documents to document the crime? Even in a trial like O.J., and I'm not saying that he was or was not guilty, but even in that trial, did you have tens of thousands of documents?
Then, of course, the thing is, if there's nothing to conceal, why is the government still concealing this? Are we trying to keep the Russians from finding out who killed the president? Are we trying to keep the Chinese communists from finding out who killed President Kennedy? Are we trying to keep the American people from finding out the truth about the illegitimate rulership of our country?
I think that one has to conclude that it's the last choice that you just said. And it's interesting to note that always the reason, because the JFK Act was passed a number of years ago, the Freedom of Information, there's a number of laws by Congress that says these documents are all to be released unless the agencies that have an objection to it, it is the burden of responsibility of the agency that wants them withheld to prove that it is a matter of national security and or sources and methods that they're withheld. Well, boy, that's really troubling now if we still have, thousands of documents that are withheld on this, because, well, who's nation's security? Are you saying that it's America's national security? Well, are you saying that the American people, if they know the truth, might rise up and take their country back and say, hey, the Constitution of the United States means something to us today, and you folks are our elected officials, we pay your salaries, and you need to stop doing this.
Well, we can fast forward now to the year 2001, and we can listen to Mr. Robert Mueller, the new director of the FBI, and they have the findings on the black box of the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. But we can't let the public hear that.
Yes.
Because it would be too trying, too traumatic for the families. We're so concerned about the families of the people who went down on that plane that we just can't release this. Now, the families are the ones who are demanding that it be released. We're so concerned about their sensitivity. Well, I think the American people have a right to know what really went on that plane.